Hi everyone, I'm Gary Nall. Once again, it's a pleasure to be able to share the latest on health and healing. And we began with a study from the University of Lausanne in Switzerland and published in the peer reviewed journal Nature Aging. And it's about a chemical called urolithin, U-R-O-L-I-T-H-I-N-A. Now what is that? It's made from ellagic acids and tannins that occur in pomegranates and berries and nuts in reversing the aging associated decline of stem cells that generate blood and immune cells. Here's what it says. It says, quote, aging comprises of hematological and immunological system functions, making older adults especially susceptible to failure, infections and tumor development, and thus representing an important medical target for broad range of disease. And so that they found that ellagic acid, E-L-L-A-G-I-C, and these ellagic tannins from food, like raspberries, strawberries, pomegranate, walnuts, are transformed by human gut microbioflora into this very important natural chemical, urolithin A. And the compound targets the cell's mitochondria, which are its energy-producing organelles. And the research identified the mitochondria abnormalities as a factor in the stem cell aging. So, in lay language, when you take the time to have yourself maybe a smoothie and you throw in some pomegranates or have some pomegranate juice unsweetened, and some strawberries, raspberries, and some walnuts or walnut butter, you're slowing down the aging process. It's that simple. And it works not only in humans, but also it boosts the animal's immune response against viral infection. So overall, you just have a better immune system too. That's good. And from the University of Texas in San Antonio comes a new research about explaining a plant's medicinal power against COVID and a cancer called glioblastoma. The plant is called Artemisia annua. That's A-R-T-E-M-I-S-I-A, A-N-N-U-A, or you might also know it as Sweet Annie. It contains medicinal compounds, and these medicinal compounds have a bioactive properties, and these bioactive properties are good against cancer cells and COVID, and that's important. Sweet Annie has been used, by the way, in traditional Chinese medicine for over 2,000 years. The plant produces artemisinin, which contains natural chemicals used in the treatment of malaria. Its leaf extracts have been used to treat a variety of other diseases, including cancer and COVID-19. So it's very important. Now, most Americans never heard of Sweet Annie, but over there they have, and they've used it it has cytotoxic activity against glioblastomas, cells that are malignant in the brain. So that's just something else to add. Now, from the University of New South Wales, exercising immediately after a study can help you remember. If you exercise, and then right after you've studied something, read something, listened to a lecture, you have a greater capacity for retaining information. That's according to this new program. And it encourages more physical activity in classrooms and nursing homes. So that's good. Now, it follows in something that I have personally observed. In all of my radio shows, lectures, I have certain points I would like to make. And then I started doing a study on this. It was just my own improvisational study in that I would do a series of lectures over a period of 3 months to the same group of people. It was called Mastering Life. Some of you in the audience may have been a part of that. It was in the mid, I did that whole series from 1985, 1995. I did over 100 lectures. But some lectures I would do that were 2 hours long, others that were an hour long. And then finally, I did a 1 hour lecture, but I did it in 15-minute segments. And I find out that is the most powerful way to remember things. So then, for example, I'm not in my studio in Florida. I'm in my studio in Texas. And we have a group doing a health retreat right now. And what they'll be doing later today is an exercise in enhancing memory. And they'll take I'll do a lecture, and the lecture will be 1 hour, and I'll divide it into two parts, 15 minutes parts. And during the 15 minutes, I'll give my talk, and then I'll ask people, now you talk out loud to yourself, go for a walk, and say, here's what I just learned, as if you were giving the lecture back. And then in each one of those four segments, ask yourself, what was the most important message? What did I learn that I didn't know, or reinforce something I already did know? And that way, by talking it, you're putting it into the mind, the brain, in a different way. So then you're going to say, ah, I can tell you exactly 5 points that I learned, maybe more, but at least 5 in every hour. And we're not learning that way. In fact, think of how many times you've watched Netflix, and you may have binged watch a particular series. But then if you were asked, what did you learn? You'll have some notions of the overview, but almost nothing specific. It'd be like watching Citizen Kane and The Godfather 1, 2, and Gone with the Wind, and Lawrence of Arabia, all one after the other after the other. You remember nothing that's important because you've overwhelmed the input system of the brain. So we should have input in small elements, like 15 minutes. So when you watch a documentary, and I tell people, if you have my documentary, only watch 15 minutes at a time, stop, and then talk it out loud, what you learned. By doing that, you'll find the important messages, and you write those messages down. Then you go back and watch another 15 minutes, and then another 15 minutes, and take breaks. The same thing when reading. If you read the book, and I'm writing a sequel to it now, Living in the Moment, Prescription for the Soul, and it's considered my most important book on human nature and self-development. People used to read the whole thing, and I say, no, there's 22 chapters. Read one chapter and then talk it out, and then take notes on what was most important. So this, what I'm saying, superimposes over what this University of New South Wales said, that exercising afterwards, so what if you did both? What if you watched something for 15 minutes or read something 15 minutes and then took a walk and talked as you walked? So just getting you into a different mindset. Now, from the University of Birmingham, which is in the United Kingdom, an article published in the Journal of Allergy and Clinical Immunology shows that vaping renders frontline immune cells unable to move to meet threats. This is very important. Inhaling vapor from an e-cigarette may be stopping frontline immune cells from working typically, as a new study shows, that even moderate smoke exposure suppresses cell activity. And that means that your neutrophils, the first line of defense in the human immune system, is enabled. And the findings are important, as previous research has shown that damaged cells caused to neutrophil by cigarette smoking can lead to long-term lung damage. So, all right? Just understand how dangerous it is. And finally, from Kyoto University in Japan, drinking green tea can help prevent artery explosion. A Kyoto University team has found that the abdominal aortic aneurysm, a condition in which the main artery becomes obstructed and bloated, developed less frequently in rats that drank green tea, polyphenols, a major component within the green tea. Now, you don't have to drink green tea to get these green tea polyphenols. You can take a tablet, and the polyphenols are in there, like 200 milligrams. But without treatment, abdominal aortic aneurysms eventually rupture and lead to death in 50% of the cases. So it's a big deal. Something that simple. And by the way, from McGill University in Quebec, one last thing. Music is more effective than drugs at releasing the brain's natural painkillers. How important is this? Well, there are 400 published scientific papers that have proven the age-old adage that music is medicine. Neurochemical benefits of music can improve the body's immune system, reduce anxiety levels, and help regulate mood in which that drugs have difficulty competing. So, if you're stressed, listen to soothing music. I think the best soothing music is flute or harp or violin and or even Gregorian chants, something that's soft, and that releases endorphins and it releases natural painkillers, natural opiates in the body, and then helps with pain. That's the latest on Health and Healing. We're going to be right back. Please stay with us. And welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. We're broadcast all over the world. And what makes us different? Well, that we do more original investigative reporting than any other radio program in American history. Yeah, we do that. More original essays, more original commentaries on challenging major corporations, governmental agencies, corruption, and what we can do about it. Yeah, we do that too. And having guests on, not to promote their book, but because they have something relevant to say, taking on controversial issues, and not staying silent when most of the media is afraid to tell the truth because how it will adversely affect them. Yeah, we do that also, and have a long history of 57 years of standing up to power and identity politics and critical race theory and wokeism and showing you the dangers of mindless thought. But there's also something we do, and that is when the public seems to be unaware of where the truth is. Which door do I open to find the truth? Is it the New York Times? Yeah, that's it. The Washington Post, absolutely. No, it isn't. Lies upon lies. And the mainstream media, more lies. Virtually the entire media, all lies, all the time. But we have a hard time wrapping our mind. Then who in the hell am I supposed to believe? Well, you just believed everything they told you about COVID. How'd that work out for you? All lies and death and destruction, permanent injury, and all of it denied. But we're going to go back to a day that's important. We're going to go back to 2003 when, with absolute certainty, 100% conviction, we were told by all the media and members of Congress and a special group in Congress, Colin Powell and Rice and Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld, that Saddam Hussein was creating weapons of mass destruction, within a decade would have a nuclear weapon, and that also was associated with 9/11 and Al-Qaeda and other acts of terrorism. None of which was true. Not a single thing was true. And Tony Blair was doing the same thing in Great Britain, in spite of the fact, and this you may not know, that the head of British intelligence had met with the top intelligence officials in the United States and wrote it all down and said they're creating a war. They're creating an invasion with no proof at all. Tony Blair had that. Is he being held accountable? No, he has 800 employees making billions of dollars a year. He has a completely sanitized reputation. That's what happens when the deep state's involved. And where's George Bush? Is he being held accountable for crimes against humanity? Absolutely not. How about Rice? She's in the current administration. So do you think that anything they've told us about Ukraine is truth? No. Anything about our supporting Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates and Yemen? No. Causing millions of people to be displaced or killed? No. So it's understandable why the American public has become disenfranchised from the people who, at one time, we were told to believe. You cannot believe the media, any of it, including much of the alternative media. So today is 9/11. So I'm going to play you a clip now. And this clip was done by the Patreon newsroom producers. And I want to thank Angelina Lemon and Ahmad Hamed and David Wright and Ian Flores Cilia and also the Johnny Harris, because they put this together. It is 100% accurate. Please watch it. Go to prn.live, scroll down to archive, scroll down to Gary Nall show notes, and you can watch this, or you can listen to it. But this is the truth that the American public only now knows about, not realizing that the very same groups of people, same institutions, the same media, many of the same individuals who lied in 2003 are lying about everything today. Now to the clip.
In the summer of 2002, the director of the British intelligence agency MI6, Richard Dearlove, traveled to Washington, D.C. to meet with the director of the CIA, George Tenet. The topic of the meeting was Iraq and its leader, Saddam Hussein. In the meeting, the CIA director shared classified information with his British counterpart, who then traveled back to London to 10 Downing Street, the home of the Prime Minister, Tony Blair. Dearlove told his prime minister everything about what was really happening behind the scenes in the United States, how the U.S. was planning to invade Iraq no matter what. It was a highly classified meeting, but notes were taken and classified and put into a memo. That memo was later leaked to British author and journalist Michael Smith, who published it in 2005. And that's what we're looking at, a secret meeting, and the memo it produced, meant only for the eyes of top British officials. It was an explosive leak. What we see is that Dearlove tells his prime minister everything he heard in Washington a few days earlier, and that this was a very different story than the one the Bush administration was telling to the public. That an American invasion was inevitable, that Bush's people were fixated on removing Saddam Hussein from power, no matter what, and that the US government was blatantly cooking up intel and facts to help sell their invasion. This document shows us how power really works in our world. How a small group of people decided to topple a dictator, to occupy a country, and then invented a story to support their plan. It was a false story, but it helped them sell a horrifying war. It's a story that is revealed in detail by the Downing Street memo.
States like these constitute an axis of evil.
One last chance to avoid war. The entire world has known that we will take whatever action is necessary.
On September the 11th, enemies of freedom committed an act of war against our country.
The United States military has begun strikes against Al-Qaeda terrorist training camps in Afghanistan.
Let's start by looking at another document from the fall of 2001, when Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz created this memo for his boss, Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense. This was just 10 weeks after the attacks that changed the course of history, but this document wasn't about that. It was about Iraq, a country that had nothing to do with 9/11. Rumsfeld reviewed the document before meeting with an army general. He marked it up with his notes, giving us insight into what the Secretary of Defense of the United States was really thinking about after 9/11. How this group of military leaders were set on, quote, building momentum to topple Iraq's dictator Saddam Hussein, to decapitate the government. A government that was no longer useful to them. Saddam Hussein had been a useful client to the United States, especially in the 80s when he was waging a war against Iran, an enemy of the United States. But those days were now over. Saddam had turned into just a troublemaker in the region, creating instability that could threaten the US's easy access to oil.
2 hours ago, Allied air forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq and Kuwait. This conflict started August 2nd when the dictator of Iraq invaded a small and helpless neighbor.
And in many ways, Iraq was an old mess in need of cleaning up. A mess that Bush Sr. had failed to resolve during the first Gulf War. Iraq was supposed to disarm itself after that war, but had kicked out the UN weapons inspector teams. But that wasn't the main reason why, right after 9/11, these guys were talking about invading Iraq. A bigger reason is that these leaders wanted to remind the world who the global superpower was. They needed to, after being brutally attacked on their own soil. A non-US-friendly regime like Iraq couldn't be allowed to stand in a post-9/11 world. Or, in the words of Rumsfeld himself, hours after the towers fell, quote, "We need to bomb something else to show that we're big and strong and not going to be pushed around." Iraq and its leader was that something else. And now Bush and his advisors were looking at a plan to make it a reality. But how to start the war? Could they tie Saddam Hussein to something that Americans feared, like 9/11 or anthrax? Or could they tell a story about weapons of mass destruction? What other countries could they bring in to support their invasion? And of course, the most important consideration, Rumsfeld jots it here at the end, they would need an influence campaign. They would need to sell the war. And when should they begin? How about right away?
Iraq continues to flaunt its hostility toward America and to support terror.
3 months later, the president was telling the world that Iraq was one of a group of evil countries that the U.S. must oppose in the global fight against good and evil.
States like these constitute an axis of evil. The price of indifference would be catastrophic.
By the summer of 2002, this idea that Bush's advisors had scratched down after 9/11 was developing into an official policy. That handwritten influence campaign to sell the war was now in full swing.
There is no doubt that Saddam Hussein now has weapons of mass destruction.
The Iraqi regime has been free to pursue the development of weapons of mass destruction.
We know they have weapons of mass destruction. There isn't any debate about it.
And this is exactly what the head of MI6 told Prime Minister Tony Blair at his house in the summer of 2002 after meeting with the CIA in Washington. It's what we see in the Downing Street memo, that there was a perceptible shift in attitude in Washington, and that the U.S. invasion of Iraq was now seen as inevitable, and that they were now fixing intelligence around a decision that they had already made, and that the U.S. wasn't really planning to work with the U.N. They didn't want weapons inspections or getting U.N. approval for military force. And crucially, the head of the MI6 tells the prime minister that these Bush people aren't really thinking much about the aftermath of such an invasion.
What is inevitable is not regime change, it is disarmament of weapons of mass destruction.
This memo wasn't supposed to be seen by anyone but just a few, and that's why we can learn from it. It serves as one of the most potent pieces of evidence that the Bush administration was maneuvering two very different stories. Their private story about the need to remove a dictator to project U.S. power, which was in stark contrast to the public story that they had to tell to sell the invasion, their influence campaign.
Any country on the face of the earth with an active intelligence program knows that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction.
Because they knew that if they were really going to sell this war, they would need to convince not only the American public, but also Congress, and at least partially the international community. What we learn in the Downing Street memo is that they had settled on two main focus points for their story. That Iraq has weapons of mass destruction, and that they're also working with the masterminds of 9/11. Not long after this meeting between MI6 and the CIA, Bush and his allies ramp up their influence campaign to sell their war.
We've learned that Iraq has trained al-Qaeda members in bomb-making, poisons, and deadly gases.
The sales pitches to the American people for an invasion of Iraq were made with absolute certainty. Certainty that Iraq had WMDs.
He had agreed, and the UN had agreed, that he would not have a WMD program. We know he does have one.
Certainty that they wanted to use them against Americans and American allies.
Simply stated, there is no doubt that Saddam Hussein now has weapons of mass destruction, that he is amassing them to use against our friends, against our allies, and against us.
Certainty that Iraq was harboring terrorists.
And al-Qaeda terrorists escaped from Afghanistan and are known to be in Iraq.
And certainty that Iraq was working on obtaining nuclear weapons.
And Iraq's state-controlled media has reported numerous meetings between Saddam Hussein and his nuclear scientists, leaving little doubt about his continued appetite for these weapons.
And these speeches were working. By the fall of 2002, Americans were in favor of an invasion of Iraq by just a narrow majority. But there was just one problem, that all of these statements were lies. Indeed, this was already known in the secret rooms of Downing Street that the US was fixing their facts and their intel to match their already made decision. Iraq's supposed links to Al-Qaeda were based on one interrogation of a guy whose testimony lacked, quote, specific details, and who was intentionally lying about it to mislead his interrogators. Bush and his allies knew this. It was clearly documented back in February of 2002. And yet, publicly, the scary story about Al-Qaeda being in Iraq continued to be sold by Bush and his people.
The Iraqi regime has plotted to develop anthrax, nerve gas, and nuclear weapons for over a decade.
The case for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq was equally thin, and senior officials knew it. Like in September 2002, when Donald Rumsfeld received this report from the Joint Chiefs assessing what real evidence there actually was for WMD in Iraq. The report is shockingly honest, and it says that the conclusion that Saddam has WMD, quote, relied heavily on analytic assumptions and judgments rather than hard evidence. That's word salad for it was speculation and conjecture. The report goes on to say that they didn't have anything solid on nuclear weapons-related facilities and concludes that they don't know of any facilities where Saddam may be producing or testing biological weapons. And so we know now that they had almost no evidence for their story about why the US should invade Iraq. And yet, even knowing this, they kept selling the same story, convincing the American people.
There's no doubt in my mind he wants to have a nuclear weapon and he's got some capacity.
Wherever threats are forming against our country, we will respond.
But they couldn't go on like this forever. They knew that if they were really going to sell this war, they were going to need to show real, convincing evidence, not to the people, but to Congress. And this is where we get another instance of fixing the intelligence to fit the policy. It came in September 2002 when President Bush asked Congress to give him the authority to invade Iraq. In response, Senate leaders requested an immediate national intelligence estimate, which is a report from the entire intelligence community meant to help Congress make informed decisions. This could be really bad for Bush and his allies. So he and the CIA get hard at work pulling together a report that fits their story, intelligence to back up all their public statements and speeches. They come out with this highly redacted report that they deliver in October of 2002. The report makes some very strong claims. They claim that Iraq has been building more WMD, that they have chemical and biological weapons, and that they will have a nuclear weapon during this decade. And to congressional leaders, this appeared rock solid. Here was the entire intelligence community coming together saying that Iraq had horrific weapons and that they wanted to get more.
Saddam Hussein has composed a scarlet chapter of terror. Our only responsible option is to confront this threat before Americans die.
There is no such thing as a Democrat or Republican war.
So in that same month, based on this report and all of these public speeches, Congress gives the green light for war. But this national intelligence estimate was deeply flawed. It was a perfect example of the fixed intelligence described in the Downing Street memo. It was put together in less than a month, totally rushed. The report had been plagued by groupthink and directed by political pressure, with the Bush administration pushing analysts to deliver a report that matched their conclusions that they had already come to months earlier. And they did this using very old intelligence. The CIA hadn't had any human assets on the ground for years, so their report wasn't even based off of anything after 1998. But it didn't matter. Bush and his allies had successfully sold the war to Congress and the American people. But there was one last hurdle. It was the international community, which would mean they would have to face the UN process that they apparently had no patience for.
Iraq has answered a decade of UN demands with a decade of defiance.
So it's November 2002, and in response to the rising tensions between Iraq and the US, the UN Security Council passes this resolution, 1441. It was a measure that was meant to give Iraq a final opportunity to comply with weapons inspections, to show the world that they had fully disarmed and had no weapons of mass destruction. Bush and his allies saw this as an opportunity. If they could somehow show that Iraq wasn't complying with this new inspection process, this resolution implied that they would be justified in invading the country. Their long-desired war would be on. But they had a problem, which is that Iraq and Saddam Hussein were complying with the weapons inspections. Over the course of 4 months, UN weapons inspectors searched Iraq from top to bottom, They were led by Hans Blix, the former head of the International Atomic Energy Agency. They conducted over 900 inspections at over 500 locations. And they didn't find anything. No WMD, no biological weapons, no nuclear weapons programs.
Iraq has on the whole cooperated rather well. Access has been provided to all sites we have wanted to inspect. Universities, military bases, presidential sites, and private residences.
Hans Blix did find two things that were important. First, they did find some ballistic missiles that the UN says have an effective range that makes them illegal, so they would need to be destroyed by Iraq. And second, there were some chemical weapons that the Iraqi regime said cannot be accounted for. But Blix insists that this does not mean that they have these weapons. It just means that they need more time to work out the accounting situation. But this error was exactly what the Bush circle needed to justify their invasion.
I call now on the distinguished Secretary of State of the United States of America.
They sent their most respected cabinet member to the UN, Secretary of State Colin Powell. He came equipped with photos of what he says are mobile weapons facilities.
Saddam Hussein and his regime are concealing their efforts to produce more weapons of mass destruction.
He plays tapes that he says prove that the Iraqis are hiding their weapons.
We evacuated everything to make sure it was not around when the inspectors showed up.
And then he says that this is solid evidence that shows that Iraq is violating the UN resolution that told them to disarm. This whole thing contradicts what the UN weapons inspectors had found in their hundreds and hundreds of inspections. They bulldoze the process and say they have justification to invade.
My colleagues, we have an obligation to see that our resolutions are complied with.
They've got the American public on board, they've got Congress on board, and now the UK is in lockstep.
This is the time for this House to show that we will stand up for what we know to be right. To show that we will confront the tyrannies and dictatorships and terrorists who put our way of life at risk.
The Bush administration abandons the UN process, and that March, his people do what they set out to do 18 months earlier, when they were looking for something else to bomb. To show who's really in charge on the world stage.
My fellow citizens, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger. America faces an enemy who has no regard for conventions of war or rules of morality.
Bush's war took the life of an estimated 500,000 Iraqis and thousands more who fought for their country. And over the course of a decade occupying Iraq, no weapons were found, no nuclear facilities, no mobile weapons labs. In fact, it seemed like Iraq had dismantled its nuclear program back in 1991 and the rest of its chemical and biological weapons just a few years later. After the invasion, the U.S. never allowed the U.N. inspectors back into the country to help with their search. The U.S. would never find a way to link the Iraqi regime to Al-Qaeda or to anthrax. Colin Powell, the Secretary of State, who played a major role in selling this war to the international community, would later say that he regrets his part in starting the war.
Deeply regret that some of the information I presented, which was multi-source, was wrong.
Hans Blix, the chief weapons inspector for the UN, would comment later that year that it is sort of fascinating that you can have 100% certainty about weapons of mass destruction and zero certainty about where they are. We may never know what was in the heart and minds of these senior leaders, whether they truly believed their own lies, whether they felt justified in the choices they made. But what we can learn from this story is how these leaders behaved when they thought no one was watching, when they thought they could tell a compelling story to the public while having a totally different set of motivations, and how with enough fear and enough deception, you can lead an entire society into an unprovoked war, changing the course of history in the process.
Our economy is in recession, and the civilized world faces unprecedented dangers. Yet the state of our union has never been stronger.
Sobering? Yes. Honest? Absolutely. Now imagine for the last 5 years, Adam Schiff and many members of Congress have been lying about Russia's control over our elections, and that's what got Trump elected. And I have no love for Trump. I don't like him on any level. But I like less those who lie to maintain power. Why aren't these people brought in when every day they were saying, we have evidence, four congressional panels, independent prosecutors were brought in with teams of lawyers, hundreds of researchers, and they didn't find any evidence at all of Russia controlling the outcome of election. Those people intervened then and tried to swing an election. And yet, where in the media have any of them individually or collectively been called out for lying to the American public? And those are people in power now. This is shameful at every level. What do you think? I'd like to hear you. Call in and share your points of view, because this is 9/11. And this is one thing that we know. We have never been told the full truth about 9/11. Do I know what happened on 9/11? I was running down the West Side Highway. The only time in my life I'd ever run south, I'd always run north to George Washington Bridge. I just returned that morning from Florida. And then I heard the plane, and I just thought to myself, that plane's going awful low, too low, because I fly a lot. I looked up, and boom, there it was. I was down there helping people on 9/11. There's actually a photograph of me doing that. I don't know who in the hell took the photograph, but someone did and sent it to me. And in any case, the outcome was that we don't know what was behind 9/11. We don't have the full truth yet. And every effort by administrations, both the Bush and the Clinton administration, to hide information, to keep from the public, they did. Why? Why not be open? But they weren't. So we still don't know the full truth behind 9/11, and the hearings were a sham. They were a disgrace. Now, I've exposed those on multiple occasions, so I'm not going to redo that now. I'd like to hear from you. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. We're going to take a break and come back, and hopefully you will have called in. And by the way, if you wonder why when I'm asking for calls and I don't get any, it's not because we censor anyone. I don't censor. We have a Kyle standing by. We have Dylan standing by to take your calls because we have a lot of informed people in this audience. I'd like to hear from you. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. On the line with us now to discuss the key points of official 9/11 narrative that are incorrect, demonstrably false, is Les Jamieson. Les has studied the actual research on 9/11 since November 2001 and has been publicly active in the 9/11 truth movement ever since, including outreach at Ground Zero to inform the hundreds or thousands of people who visit the World Trade Center site. He had a critical role in planning large annual 9/11 symposiums sponsored by architects and engineers for 9/11 truth. He is the founder of HR14.org, which provided information about the 20 pages and other 9/11 related legislation that compromises our human rights. And nice to have you with us today, Les.
Thank you, Gary. Great to be with you.
By the way, I meant to say it was Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton who were covering up after 9/11. There's a brand new bombshell filing today from Kit Clarenberg of the Gray Zone, Max Blumenthal's group. Quote, at least two 9/11 hijackers have been recruited into the joint CIA-Saudi intelligence operation that was covered up at the highest level, according to an explosive new court filing. A newly released court filing raises grave questions about the relationship between Alex Station, a CIA unit set up to track Al-Qaeda chief Osama bin Laden and his associates and two 9/11 hijackers leading up to the attacks, which was subject to a cover-up at the highest levels of the FBI. Obtained by Spy Talk, The filing is a 21-page declaration by Don Canestero, a lead investigator of the Office of Military Commissions, the legal body overseeing the cases of 9/11 defendants. It summarizes classified documents, government documents, and disclosure, the private interviews he conducted with anonymous high-ranking CIA and FBI officials, many agents who spoke to him as he headed up an Operation Encore, the Bureau's aborted long-running probe into Saudi Arabia's connection to 9/11. Despite conducting multiple lengthy interviews with a range of witnesses, producing hundreds of pages of evidence, formally investigating several Saudi officials, and launching a grand jury to probe the Riyadh run, that's Saudi Arabia's capital, U.S.-based support network for the hijackers, Encore was abruptly terminated in 2016. That's under Barack Obama. This was purportedly due to a Byzantine intra-FBI bust-up over investigating methods. And that's just part of the beginning of this. So brand new, first told to you today on the show. You can go to the Gray Zone to read the whole article by Kit, that's K-I-T, Clarenberg, K-L-A-R-E-M-B-E-R-G. Are you aware of this filing?
No, I am not, but it does tie into an awful lot of legal action that's been happening these years, all these years, by 9/11 families, where they've been struggling get the government documentation on the Saudi royal funding and FBI and intelligence collusion.
Les, I'm going to ask you just one question, all right?
Sure.
And I want you to rip through it. You are one of the few people who have had the scholarship to interview thousands of people and read their reports, and you've made a list of the contradictions to truth in the 9/11 Commission official report. Go through those contradictions and lies now to this audience.
Sure. The first big one is that the U.S. government had no warning, no inclination, no impression whatsoever that these attacks were being planned or could have happened, that there was no impression that planes could be hijacked and used as missiles and flown into buildings. Those are all false, demonstrably false. Back in 1995, there was a laptop recovered in the Philippines from one of these, quote, Al-Qaeda cells, and it very clearly delineated a plan to do just that, to hijack planes to fly into buildings. And in the at least a year before 9/11, the attacks, then there was a flurry of basically activities leaking through and getting reported. And of course, in the summer of 9/11, some of these warnings actually led to people like Attorney General John Ashcroft being warned not to take public airline flights. That was in July of that summer of 2001. And that was highly suspicious. They knew to tell him, something's brewing here. We do not want you to fly for your safety. George Tenet, head of the CIA, was also reacting to many, many warnings. And then the Richard Clark had all this chatter and was reporting on it. And then definitely afterwards, during the 9/11 Commission in hearings, he let the world know of what he was suspecting going on. And in hindsight, also August 6th of 2001, there was the release of the presidential daily briefing with the title, quote, Bin Laden determined to strike within the U.S. Those are just a few of many, many warnings.
Okay, go to
coming through.
Les, I need to pick your pace up, please. You don't have to do the details. The proof is there, and it's in lots of published areas that you can guide them to. I just want you to go through the topics real fast now.
Okay, sure. The 9/11 Commission's report, which was deemed to be the official explanation of how 9/11 happened, it lacked any information about the physical collapses of those three towers. It had nothing about WTC-7 as well, and so no physical evidence. This is critical. Also, they withheld a lot of information having to do with what's in this gray zone report that you referred to, having to do with the arrival of some of these Arabs who were the alleged hijackers, specifically, let's see, they were Khalid Al-Midar and Nawaf Al-Hazmi in San Diego. There is really a wealth of evidence showing that these were operatives that were being protected, were being facilitated, and were there was high-level collusion happening that put them in place to be part of this team of 19 who were had to be there as the cover story, as the scapegoats to put the blame on. Another thing it's very important to understand is the way it took 14 months after 9/11 for the commission to even be allowed to happen. That's highly suspicious. And once it was decided and allowed by Bush and Cheney after 14 months of opposition, they put, of all people in charge, Kissinger. And that was highly suspicious. And once the 9/11 family members, the Jersey girls, interviewed him and asked the question, do you have any royal family, Saudi royals, as part of your clientele? That was it. The next day he resigned because he had a conflict of interest. So, you know, all these years, looking back here was 22 years, and it is very important to look back at how the 9/11 Commission was basically thwarted in the first place, and then once it was put into place, they were only given $3 million and then another $11 million about a year later for a total of $14 million. Compare that to any other investigation, $60 million to investigate Whitewater and Monica Gate. You know, so all this is vital to look at and understand what obvious cover-up occurred. David Ray Griffin wrote a book called 9/11, the 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions. Harper's Magazine published a brilliant article by Benjamin DeMott from University of New Hampshire called Whitewash as Public Service and How the 9/11 Commission Report Defrauds the Nation. So here we are 22 years later, still standing on this
narrative. I need you to stay on point, friend. Please tell us specific. You don't have to go into detail now. I'm just asking you for the known and provable lies in the commission report. Please just go through this.
The provable lies are that, again, there was no understanding or expectation of attacks. That is false. And that they completely left out any references to the Saudi royals and what was in the 28 pages that was finally released 13 years after it was wrongfully classified by George Bush. That's critical because the funding and the also the collusion between the Saudi intelligence and U.S. intelligence is a critical part of the whole 9/11 operation. I can add one other thing, referencing William Binney, who you know very well. He and this was left out of the report, is that the intelligence was in place with Operation Thin Thread, the program that William Binney devised to gather intelligence on any suspicious activities and then, with protection of privacy, report it to the appropriate authorities to take action. And his program, Thin Thread, was canceled weeks before the attacks. And that Thomas Drake, then later, another whistleblower, pointed out that they had the information necessary to stop the hijackers. That's not in the report. What does this all signify? It's major.
Okay, let me add a few things very quickly. Mm-hmm. One, there were over 200 witnesses, including fire chiefs and police chiefs and people who were first responders, who heard and felt multiple bomb explosions prior to the collapse of the building in the basements. We interviewed one of the people in the building who drug a person out of the building after a door was blown off from an explosion in the basement, and he drug that person off and pulled him under a car, and otherwise both of them would have been killed. None of that was allowed into testimony. In fact, they were very selective. If you had evidence that showed that there were detonations in the building prior to the collapse, that was excluded. Right. That was left out. That's right. Crucial because you don't have hundreds of eyewitnesses. And also, as you said, they did not do a full report and allow the architects and engineers, who are highly qualified, who had no bias in this, but said that building number 7 could not have collapsed into its own footprint based upon the physics and the engineering that they all did. There was just some fires in there, and those fires did not raise to the level of causing the building to collapse. So they left all of that out.
Right.
All right.
Right.
Those are a few things also.
Right. Right. And the New York Times had the interviews of, I think, 130 firemen, all who've heard and felt explosions. That was omitted from the report.
And what about the reporter who was talking about Building 7 collapsing, and it didn't collapse? You can actually see Building 7 out the window, still standing, and then it collapsed. Where did that come from? How does a reporter suddenly get told something, and then it happens?
Yes, that was the BBC, and it occurred, it was just aired 20 minutes before the actual collapse.
Yeah, well, that's a coincidence. It just cannot be a coincidence. What I'm saying is there are thousands of discrepancies, thousands, including gigantic tons of metal beams that were thrown long distances, that were impaled into other buildings, that based upon the top forensic expert, metal expert in the United States, we interviewed at length for over an hour, said that could not have happened unless there were explosions, and the explosions would have caused that to projectile up instead of down. Because when you have a building collapse into its own footprint, it all collapses straight down. It doesn't go hundreds of yards in different directions, especially if it's a multi-ton beam. What would it call the projection? There's no dynamic in physics that would have caused it. Anyhow, there's so much that is wrong. Do I know what the actual game was? No, I do not. Therefore, I do not project what I don't know. But what I do know with absolute certainty is that everything we were told about 9/11 in its official report could be, should be, and was not challenged by the mainstream media and with the government.
Right.
And that's the problem. Thank you for your good work, and we look forward to talking again. And again, for those of you who like this brand new information, brand new as of this hour, you can go to us. You can go to The Gray Zone, Max Blumenthal and Aaron Mate's publication, and they're very meticulous in their research. And look at the 9/11 hijackers were actually CIA recruits, two of them that we know about. Now, we're going to say goodbye to WBAI and continue on at PRN.FM, going to the top of the hour. And if we have callers, we don't yet, I'd like to hear from you. We've given you a lot to think about. Remember, the very people, the same institutions, the FBI, the CIA, the deep state players and their puppets in Congress who let us into Vietnam, Afghanistan. And I have a report on Afghanistan, who really profited from Afghanistan. It's going to shock you. That's tomorrow. And then the same people, Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, they were all there, not just at 9/11, giving us misinformation, demonstrable misinformation, but they were there to give us more information that was wrong about weapons of mass destruction. As you heard, there were 800 site and visits, and they didn't even mention Scott Ritter in here, who was also on the ground doing investigations. And one person that intervened there was former Secretary of State and former UN Ambassador to the United Nations, who was the Clintons' front person, Madeleine Albright. And historically, they were all wrong. But even on ethics, Madeleine Albright was wrong when Leslie Stahl in 60 Minutes said there were about 500,000 children dead in Iraq because of sanctions. And was it justified? Now, you got to understand the backstory. And Leslie Stahl evidently didn't see the documents. We got the documents under Freedom of Information Act, showing that the Defense Department had worked with the Clintons to destroy civilian infrastructure. That is an international crime. You're not allowed to do that. And we've signed treaties that we would not destroy electric, sanitation, water, sanitation of water. And we did exactly that with the idea, and it's in the Pentagon Papers, that that would cause the public to rise up and attack the regime and overthrow it. No, because Saddam had his own water filtration systems, so his national soldiers were protected, but the civilians, especially the children, died. 500,000. She said, yes, it's acceptable. What kind of person says it's acceptable for 500,000 children to die because you want to be right about something for your own process of maintaining power in that part of the world? And look at the consequences. Have you seen any newspaper? Have you seen the New York Times or the Washington Post or Rachel Maddow? Have you seen anyone that are mouthpieces for the establishment going to Iraq today, going to Libya today, going to Syria today, going to Honduras today, going to Venezuela today, going to Ukraine, because we started the war. Russia responded, but we did it in 2014 in the coup. It's all there. It's documented. It's not conspiracy theory. And take a look at what we've created and then say, my God, how in the world did this hegemonic mindset be allowed to happen? Because you've got to see that everyone in Congress, including Bernie Sanders and all these so-called progressives, they're frauds. So do we care? Should we care? As a nation, should we care about anything that anyone in power does, ever? The answer is we should and we don't. And that's on us, not the person out there doing it. That's my opinion. Sorry we didn't hear from you, but if you call in on our program in the future, I'll be happy to take these issues. Have a nice day, everyone.